We are talking once again with Job Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing on this fine, dark, smoky Saturday?
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
It is indeed. All right, let's start out with local and regional. And I know a lot of people were probably thinking about, you know, hitting the beach later today, but that's not to be.
No, Seattle has announced late last night that Seattle parks and beaches will be closed this weekend due to the terrible air quality. Stay inside and use your air cleaners if you have them. Of course, there's an obvious reason why. Wildfires all up and down the West Coast of historic proportions. A number of people fear dead in Oregon at this point. Portland, the city of Portland, in a state of emergency with the fires to the south. I haven't seen whether they actually merged overnight or not, but they're threatening southern suburbs down around Molalla and Oregon City and Clackamas County. In the Seattle area, we've had wildfires in the east, on the east side of Pierce County and South King County and Bonnie Lake and Sumner, in central Washington and Okanagan County and Chelan County, the town of, Malden in eastern Washington and Whitman County is pretty much wiped out.
And like 80% destroyed.
Yeah. And, we know why this is happening. It's called climate change. California had the hottest July in record, 130 degrees in Death Valley. It had the driest August in history. Some 40% of the country is in drought right now. And that is climate change. And, that creates the conditions for these wildfires. And unlike a previous brain fart from our commander in chief, it's not because, states haven't been sweeping up the forest floors. In fact, we've seen some of these fires in areas like the Palouse where they're not heavily forested. They're scrubland. They're agricultural areas. And, again, it's because it's been so dry, and including on the west side of the Cascades. And we've seen that in the fires in Oregon and Clackamas County and, east of Eugene, Springfield. We've seen that in Washington State with the Pierce County fires. There's fires in Clark County. I mean, it's a serious problem. Usually we have dry weather in summer in Seattle, but not this dry and not this hot. We had 90-degree weather in Seattle on Thursday, which was September 10th. So, this is the new normal. This is where it's going to be going forward for the rest of our lives, at least. This will be the baseline from which it will get worse. And this is not just an American problem. We saw this with the Australian fires last winter, which of course is summer in the southern hemisphere, where, much of the continent of Australia was on fire, which is an even larger area than the west coast of the United States. So, the weather will probably turn, the beginning of next week, but at least through Monday, we're going to have seriously bad air quality still. And, we've already had practice with the pandemic where, we have practice in staying inside. So, that's the silver lining is that, we're already accustomed to the apocalypse. So, welcome to the new normal.
And, taking advantage of the apocalypse amongst plenty of large corporations that are continue to take advantage of it.
cough Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah. As well as, this week they had another update on the natural liquid gas refineries that they're trying to build, that they are building across the state of Washington, as well as, in Oregon. And, you think there would be some connection there between putting more fossil fuel infrastructure into the mix, literally as the nearby regions are burning.
Well, yeah, and this is yet another of the bazillion reasons why we need to change in federal government, because, you know, at this point, the Trump administration is actively working to make climate change worse. And we're seeing that in its promotion of fossil fuel industries. We're seeing that in Attorney General Ferguson filing suit this week, again, this time over drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I mean, it just goes, and that was an announcement that would have been huge news, you know, in any previous administration, but it was sort of like a footnote that was barely mentioned about a week or two ago, in the Bush in the Trump administration. It's like they're trying to deregulate and destroy as much as they can before they get forced from office. There's been a tsunami of news about, you know, different little administrative actions in one or another federal department that have been, I don't know how Ferguson is keeping up with his lawsuits at this point. I believe he's filed 73 total against Trump, of which he's won 43, 29 are pending, and one is on appeal. So he's had a very good track record against Trump. He hasn't lost yet, actually. No, he's lost the one that he is now appealing. But that's it. And I don't know how his office is keeping up with all the lawsuits, because the Trump administration is ignoring practice and ignoring protocol, and in many cases the law, just across the board right now. It's an all-out press to like destroy the planet.
Also related to the West Coast fires, I saw reports this week of different right-wing outlets that are talking about the fires being caused by Antifa and or BLM.
Yeah, and it's actually worse than that. They're not only talking about it being caused by that. There were you know, fake photos circulating on social media that Douglas County and Jackson County in Oregon had arrested Antifa members for arson. Those departments had to put out statements saying, "No, this is false. These were fake photos." And you know, you can take a wild guess as to where those photos came from. Either the right wing fever swamp or Russia or both. But at the same time, you know, you literally had people being stalked by vigilantes who thought they were the Antifa going around setting fires. This is dangerous. This is setting people, on the brink of civil war, basically, where they are willing to go out and hunt people based on this suspicion that, excuse me, that they are, you know, that they're Antifa. Which is a, you know, in rural areas like, you know, rural Oregon, that particular incident happened in Malaga, Oregon, which is not, it's urban, but it's still basically rural. You know, you've got people all too willing to believe that, that their fellow citizens are, you know, trying to destroy things for the sake of destroying them. You know, to the extent that Antifa has been present in BLM protests, they've been very targeted in their property destruction. They're not going around randomly trying to, you know, torch forests. But this is what the right wing has been doing. It doesn't have anything to do with, well, with reality, with any kind of logic. It's just, you know, who do we want to target and hate this week? You know, our 5-minute hate for the day, except it's not 5 minutes. It's hours and hours and hours. It makes me really fearful for the election season and for what happens after the election. I think this country's a tinderbox, honestly. And, you know, not just the left wing, but the right wing as well, is all too willing to hit the streets, and they're armed. And this is a very, very dangerous situation that has been created by Donald Trump. and by the modern Republican Party, which really doesn't have a political platform. It's not about governing. It's about, you know, maybe governing a little bit half the country and not only seceding from, but actively warring against the rest. I'm afraid that's what we're headed towards, including in this area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on to developments here in Seattle regarding Black Lives Matter and the continuing protests.
Yeah, well, they're not continuing this weekend. They've basically been canceled, as far as I understand, because of the air quality. But there were continuing marches through when the smoke rolled in yesterday. But we saw SPD behaving badly again. On Monday, there was the Labor Day march. Even with all the news this week, it really was a holiday week. Seems like about 3 weeks ago, but, there was an annual Labor Day march. This time the march, with a lot of labor groups, tried to march to, the Seattle Police Officers Guild headquarters south of downtown. We remember what happened a couple weeks ago when a BLM march tried this. I believe it was the Everyday March. It was on a Sunday evening, and it basically occasioned a police riot where police, drove marchers back a couple of miles, and then as they were dispersing in the International District, it was caught on video that they were viciously beating at least three of the marchers for no apparent reason. Bike cops just swarming in and beating. People may remember that video. Well, the same kind of thing happened on Monday, where they were driven back a couple miles. In fact, they were driven back all the way from 4th and Lander, all the way up to the ID and then east to Judkins Park before marchers dispersed. This time in groups, for safety purposes. In the process, one of the people who captured this debacle on video, a live streamer who goes by the name of Malcontentment Tango, lost his press pass because police had been tear gassing and pepper spraying and all the rest of it, and really with no apparent reason, they just pounced on the march. And so afterwards, Seattle Police Officers Guild President Mike Dolan, he's a piece of work. So he tweets. Malcontentment video, Tango, rather, I have your press pass. Should I put it into evidence? And he posts a picture of the press pass, which has the guy's real name on it, outing his real name. And this is problematic for a number of reasons. Number one, what is the president of SPOG doing with this that should have gone into basically lost and found? Number two, should I put it into evidence implies that, videoing this march is somehow illegal, or that Seattle police want to arrest live streamers for the crime of videotaping protests and police attacks on protests, even though that assembly was never declared illegal. They just attacked them. So they didn't even bother declaring it an illegal assembly. It basically lets you know where the mindset of the rank and file officers of Seattle Police Department are. They see these protests as, which of course are protesting police brutality, as illegal, and the marchers and the media covering the marchers as an enemy. This is seriously problematic. We've seen an uptick in police violence since Carmen Diaz took over the police department. Adrian Diaz took over the police department when Carmen Best resigned. That was on September 1st, so it's only been 12 days. We also saw the following night, on Tuesday night, two of the leaders of the Everyday March in Seattle being badly injured by SPD officers beating them. They had serious head injuries, those being TK and Taki, black women who are leaders of the march, and they were targeted by Seattle Police Department. They were badly injured. They were arrested for somehow resisting arrest, I believe, which is to say, you know, they were battering the police batons with their bloody heads. And then were arrested, handcuffed, and Seattle police took their sweet time. They were supposed to take them to Harborview. They took them to West Precinct instead. This incident happened on Capitol Hill, and took their sweet time, attending to the wounds and getting medics there. They, had literally bleeding profusely from the head, both of them. Last I heard, they are still in Harborview. They were serious injuries. And, those are going to be additional lawsuits against the city, I'm sure, that taxpayers will have to pay. SPD at this point is out of control. They are not, certainly not following or enforcing any recognizable kind of law, but they are also, just doing what they like against peaceful protesters. In Seattle, this is happening now, and it will probably continue to happen next week once the air clears and the protests resume.
And meanwhile, aren't they doing a GoFundMe for medical support?
Yes.
TKN.
Yes, they are. I posted that. Let me see if I can pull it up while we're on the air here. Talk for a minute.
Okay. Well, I looked it up. His name is indeed Mike Solon with an S.
Okay. I got it wrong.
Mike Dolan was the gentleman that was involved with organizing the WTO protests in Seattle. So that might be where the two wires crossed.
Oh, my God. I forgot about Mike Dolan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the Cash App for Tati and TK is $ capital EDM and then Seattle, all one word. $ EDM Seattle, and okay. Venmo also is EDM Seattle.
Okay, and that's the general account for the Everyday March, correct?
I believe right? So. Yes, and then they will. And then they will forward that on to the medical costs of the two leaders. Yeah.
Very good. All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move along.
All right. I think that then takes us to national, since you already touched on first.
Oh, good Lord. Yes. This was a Newsweek for the ages for national. Let's start, and I'm going to try and sort this out because it was overwhelming and a lot of stuff I'm sure people missed just because there was so much going on. Okay. Probably the most important thing of the week that happened was the whistleblower complaint. This was from a guy named Brian Murphy, who's the former head of Department of Homeland Security's intelligence, and before he was demoted, of course, because he filed a formal complaint. He's been trying to go through the channels. This is why it was a whistleblower complaint eventually. His complaint essentially outlines, along with many details of this, that the White House, through Homeland Secretary Chad Wolf, the same guy who sent, all the armed thugs to Portland, that Chad Wolf had been ordering a stand down on any information for state or local election officials on Russian cyber attacks on the election. In other words, go ahead, let them do it. Don't let the states know how they're being attacked. This basically is the equivalent, in the 20th century, this would have been somebody sending armed troops to invade the United States, and the president of the United States, who is a friend of the dictator ordering the invasion, saying, stand down, don't fight them, let them occupy our country. It's treason, basically. And it's telling DHS, which has the jurisdiction over this, along with Bill Barr's FBI, Justice Department, to go ahead, let the Russians, invade, basically. And at the same time, we had a report from Microsoft this week, of all companies, saying that Russian efforts to interfere with the election are much more pervasive and much more sophisticated and hard to detect than they were in 2016. And they include targeting election officials of both parties, state and local, county and state election offices, voter registration rolls, voting machines, all of it. That the election this year is going to be not secure, and it's not going to not be secure, combining these two news items, specifically because the Trump administration wants it to not be secure so that they can rig the vote, which really brings the legitimacy of this year's election into question, honestly. And it means that in order for Joe Biden to win, he's going to have to an overwhelming number of votes actually cast for him. And then hopefully some of those will be counted correctly, and enough of those will be counted correctly to, to beat Trump. Because Trump is cheating in as many different ways as he can. And we've seen this with the suppression of vote by mail, and the dismantling of the post office. We'll likely see it afterwards with hijinks around the Electoral College and, state selection of electors. I mean, there's just a number of different ways that the White House can rig the vote. And that is actively happening now. And the federal government is letting it happen. And it is up to state and local officials to try and prevent it, with far fewer resources. And in the case of Republican states, not necessarily with the will to prevent it. So those were two really important, news items this week. But wait, there's more. We had, several, major sort of tell-all books come out. Probably the most important was the one from Peter Strzok, who, was demonized by the right wing and driven out of the FBI. He's the former head of counterintelligence, which is basically the part of the FBI that is tasked with trying to, combat efforts to spy in this country and combat hostile foreign powers in this country. And they were the folks who opened the investigation in 2016 into whether Donald Trump was a Russian asset. And we learned a number of important things from that, that book. Probably most important is that there was never any effort to follow the money, to find out where Donald Trump is getting his money, whether there is any kind of compromise that, the Russians have on Donald Trump, and whether the Russians basically own him. So that's an open question for the President of the United States, and every action that he has taken in the last 4 years suggests that he is owned. He is a foreign asset. He is working on behalf of Russia. He may not realize it, but he's certainly behaving. His behavior is consistent, and his decisions are consistent with that. At the same time, we had a book from Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's former fixer and lawyer, who's been in and out of jail the last couple of years, and he stated his belief that folks may remember that really fishy real estate deal, one of many, of course, but there was one in Florida several years ago where a large old mansion that Trump had bought that he couldn't sell again. He bought for about $40 million, couldn't sell it for at least a year. And then suddenly a Russian oligarch comes in and buys it for $90 million. Well, according to Cohen, Trump is under the belief that that was a payoff from Vladimir Putin. And it was a $50 million profit on a white elephant. Whether or not it was intended as a bribe, that's how Trump took it. And that's how Trump has been behaving ever since. That's Cohen's testimony. And Cohen's in a position to know. Up until, 2017, 2018, he was probably closer to Trump and more aware of his business dealings than anybody else, including Melania. So, and we also had a book from Melania's former best friend and chief aide saying that, you know, don't worry about her. She's just as venal as Trump. So it's been a week.
And also Bob Woodward's book coming out.
I was getting to that.
Okay.
Let's talk about COVID. We are approaching 200,000 dead in this country. We have a bunch of areas of new hotspots, including the Dakotas and the upper Midwest. The federal government is doing absolutely nothing. The Senate, is back in session, but, still making zero effort to get any kind of relief to the American public. We still have more than 30 million unemployed. Happily, the last couple of weeks, we are under 1 million new unemployment claims per week. We had more than 20 consecutive weeks of that benchmark. We are now, we're not only, only at 800,000 per week. Now, bear in mind that the worst week of the Great Recession in 2008-2009 was about 600,000 unemployment claims per week. So we've got extremely high unemployment in this country. It's probably being underreported. And as long as the pandemic continues on, and we saw an estimate from Dr. Anthony Fauci yesterday, I believe, that this could go on until late next year. That it's not only a question of getting a vaccine, a safe and effective vaccine out and distributed, which newsflash, contrary to Trump, that's not going to happen before the election. It's likely not going to happen before the end of the year. But people have to take it. Polls show that up to half of Americans don't want to take a COVID vaccine, because the anti-vaxxer movement has become mainstream in the Republican media, social media fever swamp. Unfortunately, it's an open questioning of anything having to do with health experts or public health, which, you know, this country has gone mad. I don't know what to say about that, but in the meantime. The economic fallout is going to continue until life can get back somewhat close to what was normal before the pandemic. And that's not going to happen until the pandemic is not continuing to spread, which it is. We're now at 6.5 million infections. We're now at 200,000 roughly deaths. What we learned in the Bob Woodward book was that Trump knew it was going to be really bad. He knew it was going to be really bad from the beginning. He decided to downplay it and lie about it because he didn't want to panic people. Left unsaid when that was, he didn't want to panic the stock market. So of those 200,000 deaths, if you look at what has happened with the pandemic curve in other countries whose leaders were interested in taking action and did, it's still been bad. People have still had to endure long quarantines and all the rest of it, but they came out at the other end of it and their economies are back roughly more or less normal at this point, or at least trying to recover. That could have happened here, but, Donald Trump decided not to do that. So of those 200,000 deaths, maybe 180,000 of them are directly responsible to him and his intentional decision to not take action on the pandemic or not take meaningful action. At this point, we've had over 1,000 healthcare providers die from the pandemic, and that's directly due to a lack of PPEs, personal protective equipment that could have been ordered by the federal government but was not. They made some half-hearted gestures in that direction back in March and April, and nothing since then. And those half-hearted gestures were never followed through on. the deals to produce a PPEs, those have fallen through in terms of the federal government. It's basically been state governments that have been on their own for all of that. And they don't have the number one, they don't have the resources. And number two, they've been bidding against each other and bidding against foreign countries. It's like there's been 50 separate countries in the U.S. Trying to deal with the pandemic on their own. And, you know, it's simply been insane, and it's been sociopathic, because it's been very clear for a long time since March, basically, that left unchecked, the pandemic was going to kill a lot of people. We saw, more modeling last week, from the IDM, Institute, the program of the University of Washington that has been doing the modeling all along. And they're saying that by the end of the year, globally, deaths could triple. In the United States, they can be over 400,000. And that's without the federal government taking meaningful action, and with at least half of state governments not taking meaningful action either, because they're following the president's lead. Even in Washington state, where, we have seen, government trying to listen to the experts, we've still got hotspots. King County is still adding a couple hundred cases each day, and King County and Pierce County are seeing deaths each day. Pierce County is past Snohomish County now for the third worst county in the state after Yakima and King. And we've got 20,000 cases in King County alone so far. So this is a serious pandemic still. And what we learned from the Woodward book was that he knew, that Trump knew and decided not to do anything. And made that conscious decision and lied to the American public over and over and over again. And that probably was the biggest problem, because, people didn't take the pandemic seriously. And governors did not take the pandemic seriously in Republican states. So even though public health experts were, sounding red alarms over and over and over again and saying, do this, do that, it's going to be bad, take these steps, social distancing, wear masks, etc., there has been widespread resistance to that due to the lies of one man. And those lies have cost and will cost hundreds of thousands of lives. We had 9/11 yesterday. This is a 9/11 every 3 days in this country. This is not just foreign terrorists randomly doing things that will randomly kill Americans. This is the President of the United States doing things that are randomly kill Americans. And circling back to what we were talking about before, a President of the United States who is credibly suspected of being the asset of a hostile foreign power that is currently trying to destroy our election capacity. That's what happened this week.
Taking the U.S. out of the equation, how is the rest of the world dealing at this point with COVID? Are they making significant gains?
Well, it depends where you look. The worst outbreak is not in the United States right now. It's actually in India, which is now the second worst country in the world for confirmed cases. They passed Brazil this week for number two behind the United States, which is still has millions more cases, even though it has about a quarter of the population of India. Taking that out of the equation, the area of the world and in South America and Latin America, really from Mexico south, is doing very poorly. We're seeing a resurgence in some parts of Western Europe, particularly Spain and France, which had very bad outbreaks early on. Spain especially is having a serious second outbreak right now. And this is a human nature kind of thing. Spain had probably the longest quarantine and strictest quarantine in the world so far, where they had, I believe it was 10 weeks, where people weren't allowed outside. And they got their outbreak, which was very bad originally, one of the worst in the world, under control. And then they started trying to open things back up, and it ballooned out of control again over this past month or so. And that's simply people not wanting to take the same precautions all over again. And so you're not having compliance with public health restrictions. Other areas, for instance, Canada had a fairly bad outbreak, but that's pretty much under control right now, especially BC. BC has done very well in controlling its pandemic. They have had probably the fewest per capita infections of any of the Canadian provinces. Canada's worst outbreak was really in Quebec and in the Toronto area. But they had very good compliance with public health restrictions, which were taken immediately, and they've done very well. We know it can be done. We also know what kind of behaviors, can launch pandemics. We're seeing in this country, for example, serious problems around universities right now because of bars and people throwing large parties, you know, sororities and fraternities and such. We've seen a number of major outbreaks in different university towns around the country. Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Bradley University in Illinois shut down all its classes, and Urbana-Champaign, where the University of Illinois is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Texas Tech, University of Florida, et cetera, et cetera. But we saw this in South Korea, where there's been a mild second outbreak after they did a very good job of controlling their initial outbreak, because of, infected people going to bars. So it's bars, indoor spaces. And the concern, and one of the reasons for the 400,000 estimate from UW, is that as weather gets colder in much of the country, people go back indoors, which aids the spread of the virus, and it will also be flu season. So that will also further stress healthcare systems that are already stressed. So that's the concern for much of the Northern Hemisphere, right, around the world, not just the United States, but especially the United States, because we have community spread really everywhere in the country at this point. Whereas in a lot of countries, it's one particular area that's badly hit. Here it's everywhere because there's been no guidance from the top. Again, this is a death toll that dwarfs 9/11 by, factor of, right now it's about 64. It'll keep rising. It's due largely to the behavior of the American public that has been taking its guidance from the President of the United States, and from the lack of action on behalf and lack of a plan by the federal government to address this pandemic.
There was some articles circulating this week, possibly the tail end of last week, anyway, regarding the big motorcycle event at Sturgis that had happened several weeks back. How accurate is it, their claims that they're talking like in the hundreds of thousands of people exposed?
Okay, this was a study. This was not actually contact tracing and state health departments, but it was a study and an estimate that's fairly credible. If you look at where the outbreak, I mentioned outbreaks right now in the Dakotas and the upper Midwest. Well, that's where many of the attendees of the annual Sturgis motorcycle rally came from. That rally, along with various other events like the state fair, was allowed to proceed without any social distancing restrictions by that state's Republican governor. And some 250,000 people attended the Sturgis motorcycle rally. I believe it was the second week in August. Yeah, it's actually about 10 days, but it's very crowded. There were very few masks there. Much of it is outdoors, but there's also a lot of bars. I've actually been to the Sturgis motorcycle rally. It's insanely crowded. There's no hotel rooms for hundreds of miles in any direction. This is a very big deal in a very small town. And, the study estimated, that some 250,000 people would be, infected with COVID because of that rally, and that the costs, the public costs for healthcare, for the people that got sick, for, you know, lost economic activity, all the rest of it would be about $12 billion. That's probably fairly likely in those costs, because the disease is still spreading in places like the Dakotas. That was the estimate of what it's going to wind up being. And bear in mind, North and South Dakota combined only have about 1.3 million people. They're sparsely populated states. And the largest metropolitan areas in each state, Sioux Falls and Fargo, are at the other end of each state from Sturgis. Sturgis is in the west, they're on the east. So, this is going to continue to be a problem in that part of the country for a while. Probably for a couple of months. And, you know, we're seeing the outbreaks also in college areas and, among schools, as, we've now had, several states where teachers have died already as a result of infections they've got after they returned to in-person classes. South Carolina, Mississippi, Arizona, they're all Republican states, because they're all places where in-person classes were resumed. And this is the problem that we have with trying to combat the pandemic in this country, is that half of the country isn't taking meaningful action or doesn't take meaningful action until it gets so bad, as in the places like Texas and Florida, that they have to. This is where we are. Half of the country is being governed by a party that doesn't believe in science, doesn't believe in reality, basically. That's a harsh thing to say, but it's, this is what we've been doing for years on this show, is trying to say what we see and not pull our punches. And it was just a terrible week in the news.
And then finally on this subject, can smaller entities, rather than the federal government, keep their populaces safe? So could, for instance, Washington State, if it had the resources, be able to relatively institute policies to protect everyone, or could a county or a city, or is it just too interconnected to be able to do that?
Yeah, well, there's two problems. One is it's too interconnected. I mean, there's nothing, you certainly can't do it at the county level, because people travel every day between counties. People commute between Snohomish and King County, between Pierce and King County, between Pierce and Thurston County, et cetera. And in rural areas, that's even more pronounced. So that's one problem. The second problem is getting the populace to comply, because, for instance, with the initial outbreak in King County, in Washington State, we actually had very good widespread compliance west of the Cascades. You still had a significant outbreak, just because, if 90% of a county of 2 million people, that is King County, is complying, that's great. That's a great level of compliance by public health standards. But it still means that 20,000 people or 200,000 people are not complying. So you're still going to have an outbreak. So that's one problem. And then you had widespread non-compliance east of the Cascades, because you had, the right-wing media and the president saying, don't wear a mask. And that somehow became politicized. So Yakima County suddenly became the worst per capita outbreak, not just in the state, but in the western United States, which is saying something. And Yakima County is still the second worst number of confirmed cases in the state, even though it's something like maybe sixth or seventh among counties in population in Washington State. So those are the two problems: noncompliance and interconnectedness. It would still be very hard at the county level and at the state level. I mean, Washington State, two of its three major metropolitan areas are adjacent to other states. That is Spokane, where people commute to and from Idaho, and Clark County in Southwest Washington, where Washington and Portland are very interconnected. So it would still be very, even though Washington is a fairly rural state, its largest metropolitan area would be relatively easy to isolate. The state itself couldn't be. So it would be, it'd be difficult. Now the interesting thing is that the Spokane interconnectedness with Northern Idaho is really the only, area you may remember that, you know, Washington, Oregon, and California and, Nevada formed a West Coast Compact at one point to try and coordinate their response to the pandemic in a way that the federal government wasn't. Northeastern states did the same thing. Some Midwestern states did the same thing. And the Spokane area is among those four states really the only area that has a metropolitan area near a state line. So it could conceivably be done with those four states as a, you know, West Coast Compact. Depending on what happens with the election, maybe they'll secede.
Republic of Cascadia.
Basically, yeah. Plus the desert. We'll see what happens, but, it would be very difficult to contain without, coordinated effort from the federal government. Hopefully a Biden administration would do that. Hopefully enough people want this pandemic to end someday that Biden will be able to get into office. But, there's a lot of steps between now and then. And voting is only one. Incidentally, yes. I'm going to be putting out, election recommendations early this year. Before ballots are actually mailed so that people can take ballots to drop boxes, get ballots in as soon as they possibly can this year. We want those votes to be counted.
All right. And finally on, although we were really doing a lot of international there too, but, on national, you, had an item about, health program in, New York.
Do I have that right? Oh, yeah. Actually, there was one other important development around the whole constellation of whistleblower stuff, which is one of the October surprises that I've been expecting for a while now is you remember that both Rudy Giuliani and William Barr have been traveling all over the world for the last year trying to gather dirt planted by Russian intelligence, no doubt, on Hunter Biden and Ukraine and Joe Biden's corruption in not prosecuting his son and, you know, all this other right-wing fever swamp conspiracy stuff that is being very taken very seriously in the Department of Justice. That investigation has been falling under the jurisdiction of a U.S. attorney from Connecticut named John Durham. And his staff person who's been coordinating that investigation is a 30-year U.S. prosecutor named Nora Danahy. Nora Danahy resigned yesterday without explanation. Her colleagues are saying the reason she resigned is that William Barr has been pressuring the investigation to produce results before Election Day so as to either slime or actually indict, depending on whether they've also convened a grand jury, Joe Biden. This is a October surprise that has been in the works for a year that I am honestly expecting some sort of prosecution or indictment of Joe Biden. Now, in order to be at all meaningful, that would have to happen in the next month. And reportedly, the reason Danahy resigned, this 30-year prosecutor, with a long career with the DOJ, as a nonpartisan prosecutor, that she, was being pressured to produce a report from that investigation, presumably, recommending prosecution, before the election. And probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks. So that may delay that report, but I am still expecting it. And now we've got, fairly blunt evidence that it's coming, and that it's coming very soon. So, so what else were you asking about?
New York Fire Department.
Yeah, this was something else we found out this week, on 9/11, no less, that, you may remember, John Stewart's star term before Congress a couple of years ago, where he finally shamed them into putting significant resources into a trust fund for, firefighters and first responders in New York City who had, serious health departments after 9/11 because they breathed the burning asbestos and all the rest of it. Well, we found out on yesterday on 9/11 this year that the Treasury Department, which is, responsible for dispersing that money to a health program that's been set up by the Fire Department of New York, has been skimming that money without telling anybody. In other words, putting some sort of a slush fund together. Maybe the slush fund from the inauguration is running out finally. That, is basically stealing money that is meant to give financial support to first responders and former first responders who are sick because they went into harm's way during 9/11 to try and save people and put out the flames. If that is not one of the most disgusting stories that I have ever heard, and mind you, I'm not a huge fan of the fetishization of 9/11, especially now that we've got a much more serious, basically, Holocaust going on right now, where we're under attack by our own president. But, you cannot question the heroism of the people who went into harm's way that day and saved a lot of lives. And to be basically stealing money that is earmarked for their health by Congress for their health care and sending it God knows where. Maybe it's helping to build the wall to create, a health catastrophe on the other side of the wall. This is a sociopathic administration and a completely lawless administration at this point, because who's going to enforce the law? Not Bill Barr. It's an appalling story, and it's one I wanted to highlight because, there's so much going on this week that people can miss stuff like that very easily.
Yeah. All right, let's jump to international. You were talking about Latin America in terms of COVID, but there are riots in
Bogota. Yeah.
Bogota.
Riots in Bogota, Colombia this week. Now, last month there was in June, there was a very large rally in Bogota, as there were in many places in the world, in support of Black Lives Matter in the United States, because police violence has been an ongoing problem in Colombia's country of Colombia as well as many other countries. And it has racial overtones in Colombia, which, like many countries in Latin America, has basically mestizo population and Afro populations, and the blacker the skin, the worse off people are economically, and the worse the police repression is. So Black Lives resonates in a lot of Latin America because it's a local issue as well. So on Wednesday in Bogota, you had a 42-year-old lawyer who was out of work because of the pandemic, because Colombia has been very hard hit by the pandemic. And so he was working as a taxi driver, and he was and there's a quarantine going on in Bogota and other Colombian cities because of that pandemic. And so he was pulled over by police for violating the quarantine because he's trying to make a living. And somehow he was tasered so many times that it killed him. The ensuing riots, when video started circulating of that killing, 7 people were killed in the riots, and a lot of this is a city of 10 million, mind you, and there were fires all over the city. It was a very bad scene, and this is This is in response to the killing of somebody who was pulled over for, violating quarantine, basically, which is, at best, in our legal system, that would be considered a misdemeanor. And this was also in the wake last month of the killing of a 25-year-old man for violating quarantine. And these also were both darker skinned men. And so, this was the response in Latin America. And it shows you, and Colombia also has a very right-wing national government right now. So it shows you that the sort of fraying of society that's happening in the United States is not just happening here. The pressure of the pandemic and particularly of neo-fascist governments in a lot of different countries is really ripping apart societies in a serious way. And add climate change and the effects of climate change with things like the wildfires this past week and widespread drought, people in a lot of rural areas being unable to make ends meet. We're headed for a rocky 21st century.
All right, and finally, can you give us an update on Belarus?
Yeah, the protests are continuing in Belarus again this weekend, and a very concerning escalation of tactics in that one of the leaders of the opposition in Belarus, a woman named Maria Kolesnikova. That's one language I do not speak. Was basically snatched off the street and has been disappeared by the Lukashenko administration. Now, bear in mind that Lukashenko is an ally of Vladimir Putin. He is basically taking his marching orders, as is apparently Donald Trump, from Putin in terms of tactics. And so, Kolesnikova was described as one of the campaign partners of the candidate for the election that was held last month, named Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. I did practice those names too. She's in exile in Lithuania right now, a neighboring country. Probably not safe there either. Excuse me. Air quality. It's not good in here. And I've been talking for an hour.
Yeah.
So, that's an escalation of tactics to just basically disappear opposition leaders. And, with an active Department of Justice investigation of the Democratic presidential nominee right now that is nearing an end, I think it's a setup for, very unprecedented tactics in this country as well. And between that and the voter suppression and the post office suppression and all the other things that we're seeing, it's all converging and it's all going to converge in the next 7 weeks. And then who knows what happens after that? The future is unwritten. So, vote early. Vote and, get organized because I don't know what's going to come after the election. It's a very uncertain time.
All right. And, events, as you stated before, they are, none of the traditional marches are happening this weekend due to the smoke.
Yeah. You can find out, when the marches resume, the Morning March Seattle. That's the name of the Facebook page for Morning March Seattle. And then Seattle Evening March, all one word, is their Instagram page. And those two places are where you can find out where those respective marches resume. They've been marching every day, but they are on hiatus in order to breathe right now.
Sure.
And then also there is a smoke shelter that has been opened by the city for unhoused people. Because this is not a good time to be homeless. That is being operated by the Salvation Army at 1045 6th Avenue South. It's east of the stadiums, south is downtown. So 1045 6th Avenue South, to get into a air-filtered area where you're not breathing the smoke all day and all night.
Well, we will hopefully talk to you, and perhaps Maria will be back next week.
I hope so. I hope she's somewhere where she can breathe.
As do I. All right. Thank you.